Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments, historical what ifs.
It is so good to be here. Today, we are diving into what might be the single greatest pivot point in English history. We're calling this episode The Unseen Kingdom, Britain Without the Norman Conquest.
This is a topic I've been personally obsessed with for years. I mean, think about it. The very language I'm speaking right now, the words coming out of my mouth, are a direct consequence of a single battle in 1066. The idea of what English might have sounded like, something far more Germanic, perhaps closer to modern Dutch or Frisian, it's just a mind-bending concept.
It really is. And for me, it's always been the social and political angle. The idea of the Norman yoke, this complete replacement of an entire aristocracy. Was Anglo-Saxon England really this freer, more egalitarian society? Or is that a romantic myth? What would have happened if that unique Anglo-Scandinavian culture had been allowed to continue its own evolution?
Exactly. Because this wasn't just a new king on the throne. It was a seismic shift. It was a revolution in law, in land ownership, in architecture. I mean, castles started popping up everywhere. It changed the entire relationship between the people and the land. It's a fundamental remaking of a country from the top down. So today we're going to peel back the layers of history. We're going to stand on Senlac Hill on that fateful day in October 1066 and ask the ultimate question.
What if Harold Godwinson had won? What if William the Bastard had remained just that and never become the conqueror? What would that England, that unseen kingdom, look like? And how would those ripples have changed the world we live in today?
And let's start right there, on the battlefield. Because even in victory, Harold's situation is incredibly precarious. This isn't a clean win. His army has just force-marched the length of the country, fought a brutal battle at Stamford Bridge, and then marched all the way back down to face the Normans. They are exhausted, battered. Winning at Hastings would have been, in itself, a near miracle.
So it's not a case of the victorious king riding back to London for a massive parade. It's more like he wins, plants his standard on the hill, looks around at the carnage, and thinks, right, now what?
Precisely. Because his two brothers, Gurth and Leofwine, are historically killed and Hastings. In our scenario, do they survive? If they do, that's a game changer. Suddenly, the House of Godwin isn't just Harold, it's a secure dynasty with powerful, loyal magnates ready to lock down the country.
Oh, that's a huge point. With his brothers alive, he has a trusted inner circle. He can delegate. He can send Gyrth to secure the southeast while he deals with the north. You don't have that power vacuum that so often follows a major battle.
But even with his brothers, the threats haven't vanished. William might be dead or retreating back to Normandy, but remember who's still waiting in the wings. You have Edgar Etheling, the teenager with the arguably better blood claim to the throne, still floating around. And more importantly,
the Danes, Swain too.
Swain II. He saw England as his inheritance from Canute the Great. He's not just going to shrug and say, oh well, Harold won, I'll go home. He's going to see a kingdom that's been ravaged by two invasions in a single year and think it's ripe for the picking.
So, you're suggesting a third major conflict? A Harold Godwinson versus a Swain II showdown? In, say, 1067?
I think it's almost inevitable. But here's the difference. This is a Harold who has now defeated Harold Hardrada and William the Bastard. He is, without question, the most formidable military commander in Northern Europe. His authority, his charisma among the English Fyrd would be off the charts. He's a living legend.
Yeah, the morale boost alone is immeasurable. They're not fighting for a new, untested king. They're fighting for the man who saved England twice. But does that victory change England's entire orientation? The Normans dragged England, kicking and screaming, into a French continental orbit. Does a victorious Harold keep England's focus on the North Sea?
I think it has to. The political, economic, and family ties are all there. The links are with Denmark, with Norway, with the German trading cities. The whole political axis of the country remains tilted north and east, not south across the channel. The English Channel becomes a barrier again, not a highway.
Wow. So you're talking about a fundamentally different geopolitical entity. An Anglo-Scandinavian North Sea power, rather than a sort of Anglo-French kingdom. The implications of that alone, for the next 1,000 years, are just staggering.
Staggering is the word. Because it's not just about alliances and trade routes. It changes the very soul of the country. I keep coming back to the language. If the entire ruling class, the entire legal and clerical establishment, isn't replaced by French speakers for the next 300 years, what are we speaking right now?
Right. We touched on it being more Germanic. But what does that actually mean for the person on the street? Is it just a thicker accent? Or is it fundamentally a different tool?
Oh, it's a different tool entirely. Think about it. We wouldn't have this massive glut of synonyms we have in modern English. You know, kingly from Old English, royal from French, regal from Latin. You'd just have kinninglick. The language would be, I think, less layered, perhaps more direct. All of its new words would be built from its own internal roots, the way German does, rather than importing them wholesale from France and Rome.
So a word for, say, computer wouldn't be computer. It would be something like a wrecking box or a thought hoard.
Exactly. A word hoard is literally the Old English term for one's vocabulary. That's how they thought. And that mindset, that way of building a world through language, would have continued. Imagine a Shakespeare writing in a purely Germanic English. The texture of his poetry, the very rhythm of it, would be unrecognizable.
That's wow. It's a completely different literary tradition. The entire canon is gone. No Chaucer complaining about his French-inflected English. But does that cultural shift extend to religion? William had the Pope's blessing. He came with a papal banner. Harold did not.
That is a massive, massive point. The Anglo-Saxon Church was unique. It was in communion with Rome, yes. But it had its own saints, its own traditions, a strong history of vernacular scripture. It was much more independent. Stigand, the Archbishop of Canterbury in 1066, was actually excommunicated by the Pope. The Normans came in as a reforming, centralizing force, determined to bring England into the Roman mainstream.
Wait, so without them, does that independent streak continue? Does England become this rogue Catholic state on the edge of Europe? Doing its own thing?
I think it's very possible. You have a king in Harold who has no debt to the Pope. He won by himself with his English army. The church remains in the hands of English bishops who are loyal to him, not to some distant pontiff. The connection is there, but the subservience isn't.
So, the seeds of the English Reformation are sown in 1066, not in the 1530s with Henry VIII. It's not about a divorce. It's about a pre-existing sense of spiritual independence.
It could well be. The entire relationship with continental Europe is different. It's a relationship of equals, particularly with the Scandinavian and German spheres, not one of a conquered province being civilized by its French-speaking, Rome-allied masters.
So you have a more culturally and linguistically cohesive England. The massive gap that opened up between the French-speaking lords and the English-speaking peasantry, it never happens. The lord in his hall speaks the same language as the farmer in his field. That has to change everything about social mobility, about law, about a sense of shared identity.
It changes the entire concept of rebellion, doesn't it? A peasant revolt isn't just the downtrodden rising up against a foreign-speaking master. A baronial dispute with the king. It isn't this class of Norman descendants fighting for their rights against an Angevin king. The entire political dynamic is homegrown.
So, a document like Magna Carta, does it even happen? Or if it does, is it a fundamentally more democratic document from the start? Because the line between a minor thing and a great earl is cultural, not a linguistic chasm.
I think it has to be. The whole legal system would be different. You wouldn't have this imposition of French feudal law. You'd have an evolution of Anglo-Saxon common law. The role of the village moot, the hundred court, those local, communal forms of justice might have been strengthened, not swept away.
So we're looking at an England that is, in its bones, more communal, more Scandinavian in its political DNA? Less centralized, perhaps. Less ruthlessly efficient than the Norman state became.
That's the trade-off, isn't it? The Norman state was brutal, but it was incredibly effective. It created a powerhouse that could project force into France for centuries. This Anglo-Saxon England, it might be a freer, more culturally unified place, but is it as strong on the world stage? I'm not so sure.
That's the big lingering question for me. We've built this picture of a North Sea-facing, culturally independent, linguistically Germanic nation. What does it do in the world? Does it ever look west, across the Atlantic? Or does it remain consumed by the politics of Scandinavia and the Holy Roman Empire?
Without the rivalry with France, which was a direct result of the Norman Duke becoming the English king, the impetus for a massive navy, for looking out into the Atlantic, it just isn't there in the same way. The entire drive for empire might never happen.
Wow. No British Empire. That's a ripple effect that changes the entire modern world. The history of North America, India, Africa, all of it, completely rewritten.
It's almost too vast to comprehend. And when you pull it all back, you have these two diverging paths. One is our history, Anglo-Norman, French-facing, leading to empire and the English we're speaking now. The other is this ghost, a tougher, maybe a more insular, Germanic England that retained its own word hoard.
I have to admit, there's a part of me that mourns for that ghost, for that lost literary and cultural tradition. I wonder what sagas we might have had, what poetry. It feels like a whole world of art and thought was, well, not erased, but buried under a mountain of Norman stone and French vocabulary.
I see that. I do. But I also see the other side. That the friction, the clash between those two cultures, is what created the spark. It made English this incredibly rich, complex, hybrid language. It forced England into a European context that it might otherwise have shied away from. It's impossible to say which is better. They're just profoundly different.
A completely different branch on the tree of history. And it all comes down to one day, one hill, and whether an arrow flew high or low. 1,000 years of our world, balanced on the edge of a shield. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is, and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.